Coming up, difficult times are forcing many churches to reduce salaries, lay people off, and cut back their ministries.
The recession's hitting everybody, and it's affecting churches just as much as it is, mom-and-pop homeowner.
Also, in France, a centuries-old tradition, the pilgrimage.
I'm pretty tired, but other than that, it's invigorating. Spiritually lifted, that's for sure. It's amazing to be with tons of Catholics, thousands of them.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Fred DeSam-Lazaro, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. Extraordinary scenes from Iran this week as hundreds of thousands took to the streets in protest over the disputed presidential election. Iranian officials say President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad won by a landslide. But supporters of the main opposition candidate, Mir Hossein Mousavi, claim the election was rigged. The Islamic Republic of Iran has a quasi-theocratic government, and the protests put new pressures on the cleric-run establishment. Kim Lawton has more.
In the week of mass demonstrations, many supporters of opposition leader Mir Hossein Mousavi did something almost unthinkable. They challenged Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei.
It's believed that he more or less authorized the rigging of this election.
Genevieve Abdo is an Iran analyst at the Century Foundation. She says some of the protesters went so far as to call the Ayatollah a dictator.
This is really, really unprecedented in Iran, where people on the streets in such great numbers are shouting against the supreme leader. It's actually illegal to do that. People are imprisoned for doing that.
In an unusual sermon during Friday prayers, Khamenei called the election definitive and said there was no fraud. He urged Iranians to unite behind their Islamic government. Still, he's ordered the Guardian Council, a body of 12 clerics and Islamic law experts, to look into the situation. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has strong support from religious conservatives.
He is considered to be a very spiritual person. And this is also something that he capitalizes on, which is one way that he makes sure that this base of religious, conservative Iranians living in the provinces continue to support him.
But Ahmadinejad also has religious opposition, including from some clerics. Abdo says it would be a mistake to see this as a secular religious dispute.
If you watch television, you'd think that society is sharply divided between secularists supporting Mousavi, religious people supporting Ahmadinejad. The reality is much more complicated than that. Those supporting Mousavi are also religious. It's not they don't want clerics involved in politics, they don't want clerics involved in their lives. It's just certain clerics.
Abdo doesn't believe the Islamic Republic is in danger of toppling, but she says some structural changes may be inevitable. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
We have more of Kim's interview with Genevieve Abdo on our website at pbs.org. Elsewhere in the Middle East, former President Jimmy Carter visited Gaza to help promote peace in the region. Carter asked Hamas leaders to recognize Israel and concede to other demands that would end a two-year international boycott, a call Hamas officials rejected. The former president visited Gaza after stops in Lebanon, Syria, and Israel. He said people who live in Gaza are being treated, quote, like animals, and called Israel's blockade there an atrocity. There was a tiny bit of good news about the world's displaced people, but it didn't last long. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees reported the number of uprooted people went down by 700,000 last year compared to 2007. However, conflict since then in Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and Somalia have more than offset that decline, and the commissioner said humanitarian agencies are severely short of money. Worldwide, the UN says 42 million people are forced to live away from their homes, almost two-thirds of them displaced within their own countries. The U.S. crackdown on terrorism has hit Muslim donors and charities hard, according to a new report from the American Civil Liberties Union. The report alleges that laws that are too broad and unfairly enforced have cost Islamic charities money. And the ACLU said those statutes present challenges for Muslims who want to fulfill their religious obligation to donate. The report pointed out that 9 Islamic charities have closed since the September 11th attacks. President Barack Obama has extended some benefits to same-sex partners of federal employees. Among other things, the move allows government employees to take leave to care for sick partners. Many gays and lesbians want the president to do more, but the Family Research Council claims the change violates federal law that defines marriage as the legal union of a woman and a man. Meanwhile, as religious leaders are mobilizing for comprehensive immigration reform, the president spoke Friday at the 8th Annual National Hispanic Prayer Breakfast. He reiterated his support for overhauling the nation's immigration policies.
We must never forget that time and again the promise of America has been renewed by immigrants who make their story part of the American story. We see it in every state of our country. We see it in our families and in our neighborhoods.
For many people struggling through these hard economic times, the church has been a place to find solace and, for some, a food shelf. However, when it comes to paying the light bill, the phone bill, and the mortgage, some churches are finding themselves as hard-pressed as their congregants. While charitable giving to churches actually went up overall in 2008, many worship communities have been forced to lay off employees. Some even face the threat of foreclosure. Saul Gonzalez has this report from Southern California.
At the recent Worship Facilities Conference and Expo, held in Long Beach, California, the business of marketing to places of worship was on full display. At this twice-a-year national convention, companies try to sell their products and services to churches and religious institutions.
Maybe two cameras to cover the minister and the choir.
Their wares range from sophisticated video production gear to pews for churches and synagogues.
This is the Cadillac. This is our theater seat, a completely wooden theater seat.
Banks and credit unions that specialize in lending and financial consulting to houses of worship also attended.
We don't necessarily go by loan to value. We're looking at the cash flow is what we're looking at.
Although there was plenty of hustle and bustle on the convention floor this year, the recession cast a pall over the expo.
In 25 years, it's never hit us this hard before.
Steve Crow is an architect whose firm specializes in church design. With congregations cutting back on expansion and new construction plans, Crow is seeing his business plummet.
We're not having to lay off a lot of people yet, but we're cutting back on hours and just trying to hang in there right now. We're taking a lot smaller projects than we used to just to keep everybody busy.
The recession's hitting everybody, and it's affecting churches just as much as it is, mom-and-pop homeowner.
Eric Knowles is the founder and CEO of Church Brokers, a San Diego firm that specializes in church real estate and financing.
Right now, most of the churches we've been working with, probably the last year at least, they're all pulling their reins in and they're not spending anything outside of the hard, fast debt they have to pay. Salaries are getting cut back. People are getting let go. A lot of churches are letting their staff go or reducing the pay, going to part-time. So it's challenging times for churches right now.
One house of worship struggling to keep its doors open in the down economy is Long Beach's Emmanuel Church, which is part of the United Church of Christ.
Foreclosure is a possibility and something that we are concerned about.
And to those out there who think of churches as being foreclosure-proof.
Oh, no, forget it.
With revenues down, Reverend Jane Galloway's church is struggling to pay off a more than $850,000 mortgage and loans used to pay for repairs of this more than 80-year-old building.
Talking with our mortgage broker, I said...
To stay afloat, the church has cut expenses, and Reverend Galloway has volunteered to slash most of her own pay. But despite the belt tightening, every bill that arrives brings a new challenge.
I mean, we're literally at a point where my husband walked in the other day and said this was on the side door, and it was a turnoff notice for the utilities. Now, we are at a scary moment. And we know that, each month, if we're unable to make our mortgage payment on time, we could be, we, the default process could be filed and a foreclosure proceeding could begin.
Although no single hard number exists, banks and credit unions that lend to houses of worship report a steady increase in church bankruptcies and foreclosures. One of them is this 1,000-seat church north of San Diego. Built just in 2005, it closed last year after the church defaulted on loans. Even wealthy and powerful megachurches, such as Southern California's Crystal Cathedral, have had to cut staff and put millions of dollars worth of property up for sale to help pay off debts. Whether they're big or small, many churches' money troubles stem from its steady decline in giving. According to the Christian research company, the Barna Group, American churches got between $3 and $5 billion less in donations than they expected to receive during the last quarter of 2008. That's about a 4 to 6% decline.
I thank you to so many of you who have given faithfully using this envelope. It really helps us pay the bills and do what we do as a ministry and helping people and loving God and loving people.
Phil Harrington is pastor of Pathways Community Church in Santee, California.
We have a number of people in our church right now that are unemployed, that have lost jobs. People who used to be significant donors in the church just flat out lost their income. And maybe they can still give in a smaller way, but that affects our overall income.
In response, Pathways has had to cut staff and fill more positions with volunteers.
Houses of worship that face foreclosure and other financial troubles often get into their predicaments for the same reason that homeowners and consumers do: borrowing and spending too much money when times are good and not being prepared when the economy goes from boom to bust.
You know, churches are no different than literally business owners or homeowners. We all believed that everything was going to continue to appreciate, that there was no turning of the curve. And so everybody was over-leveraging, and churches are no different. They were not exempt.
Real estate broker Eric Knowles, a devout evangelical Christian, says churches' financial problems are sometimes made worse by leaders who are unable to face harsh economic realities.
There's that faith that, you know, often we think that the Lord is directing us to go do something. Well, and how do you refute that? When I deal with a pastor that says, well, the Lord's called me to buy this building, and I've had many situations where it will not pencil. We run our analysis and we get real involved and detailed. But then the pastor continues to say, well, I believe that God has directed me for this. And it's like, goodness, so what do you do? What do you do? We give the best counsel we can. We give it to them pragmatically, you know, documented in writing that this is where you're going to be. And oftentimes a pastor will look me in the face and say, well, you know what? I understand what you're saying. I understand that by earthly standards, this will not work, but God has called me to do it. And that's the trump card. What do? You just kind of like, okay.
In both good economic times and bad, some churches are supplementing what goes into collection baskets by finding new and creative ways to raise income. For instance, with assistance from investors, Pathways Community Church purchased this once dilapidated shopping mall. The church occupies the space that was once a supermarket, but rents out the rest of the center to other businesses. The revenue earned helps the church pay operating expenses and mortgage payments that total over $21,000 a month.
Right now, it's helping us survive. If we didn't have that right now, we would have to massively downsize staff and personnel and do a lot less ministry out in the community than we're doing right now. So it's opened all kinds of doors for us.
I think it could be shared space, perhaps like a collective office space.
But as they try to guide their churches through turbulent economic times, the strain is taking a toll on some religious leaders, such as Reverend Galloway.
I really want this to work. And I feel a sense of responsibility. I'll let myself be this vulnerable because you're asking me this. I feel a sense of responsibility to the people I am here for. People come here with broken hearts. People come here looking for food, looking for spiritual food. And I hear the kind of despair they're in. And I realize it's crazy for me to be this preoccupied with the finances of some place when I'm here to create a place where people can come to find solace. So I feel a sense of responsibility to the people who come here for that kind of nurturance.
We've developed what we call our McDonald's approach to church design.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
It's our church in a box.
At the expo, those attending hoped the recession would soon end, allowing houses of worship to focus not on their money problems, but on their ministries. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Saul Gonzalez in Long Beach, California.
On our calendar, Wiccans celebrate Litha on Sunday. The day, also known as Midsummer's Eve, coincides with the summer solstice. Earlier this month in France, an annual event took place that's been described as perhaps the largest public expression of traditional Catholicism in the world. It is a three-day, 72-mile pilgrimage from Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris to the Cathedral at Chartres. A history professor from New York City who has made the pilgrimage several times describes the experience.
My name is John Rao. I'm associate professor of history at St. John's University. I've done the pilgrimage to Chartres about six or seven times. And the regular preparations involve making sure you've got the right footwear more than anything else. Being a New Yorker and not owning a car, I walk a lot. You've started from a point, Notre Dame, which has this extraordinary impact on you because of its beauty and because of the fervor of the people praying and singing in it, and what the architecture of the cathedral and the light passing through the windows does is it makes it clear that God, the Father of lights, provides us a world which was incredibly more diverse and beautiful than anyone might think. The route to Chartres begins the first morning mostly in Paris and the surrounding areas. When we're talking about the people who make up the pilgrimage, the first thing to note is that probably about 70% of them are young people, people in their late teens and in their early 20s. They're people from all over Europe. The majority are French, of course, but from every country that I can imagine, from Africa, from Asia, from the United States.
A lot of these chapters are groups that stick together at home, and they've got a lot of their own particular songs, which are not specifically religious, but often focused on just subjects involving history and culture of the country as well. It's so clear, it's so sunny. By the afternoon, people are going to start suffering from the heat, you know. A big thing for people who haven't done before is just to get them to drink water.
The Mass on the first day, it's usually in a field. The Masses that are held during the pilgrimage and at Chartres itself are the traditional Latin Mass, in other words, the liturgy before the reforms that are associated with Pope Paul VI. You have perhaps, certainly at least, 100 priests who are hearing confessions during all of this. And they're scattered all through these lunch scenes and in the woods and in little deserted areas. And their Catholicism is a fervent Catholicism, traditional in the sense that it's very much focused on a spirituality that uses the traditional liturgy of the church, takes that very seriously, the traditional devotions, the traditional Latin liturgy. And then they have to give communion to as many as 10,000 people. The pilgrimage began in the Middle Ages. Chartres was always an important place and had great meaning in the life of the Christian world in the Kingdom of France. Joan of Arc made this pilgrimage. Louis XIV, I believe, made the pilgrimage. After Vatican II, there was a lot of confusion that developed in Catholic believers' minds about what they ought to be doing, what they ought not to be doing, whether they were putting too much of an emphasis on particular practices that somehow or other had become outmoded. And as a consequence, things like pilgrimages ended up suffering. It resumed precisely due to the concerns of groups that by this point were calling themselves traditionalists, who wanted to commit themselves to maintaining practices which they felt to be spiritually extremely beneficial. It's the second day of the pilgrimage. The mass is in the woods. Same kind of mass, beautiful music, priests hearing confession.
My name is Michael Matt. I'm the head of the American contingent, the American chapter for the Chartres pilgrimage. It's definitely a youth movement. They very easily, in many instances, can really tap into this whole tradition, the foundation of the Catholic faith. It doesn't matter that they don't understand every word of the Latin. They're attracted to the sacrality of the liturgy. They're attracted to the rubric and to the ritual and to the idea of suffering for what you believe in.
Can you smell the grass? Can you feel your feet? This is the real world, especially when you put rosaries into it and traditional masses and allegiance to the Holy Father. This is the real world that we're all seeking.
The entire pilgrimage is of an impact that's hard to describe. A pilgrimage is a microcosm of what life is. Life, from a Catholic standpoint, is a pilgrimage from birth to death, from our birth to our ultimate eternal experience with God. And what the pilgrimage does is it takes you for a short space of time to a time out of time. You're out of your ordinary daily experiences. All of the ordinary things that bother one during the course of a day just disappear. Even to the point, in a physical way, that after a couple of days, you don't care what you look like.
I'm pretty tired, but other than that, it's invigorating.
Yeah.
So, yeah, spiritually lifted, that's for sure. It's amazing to be with tons of Catholics, thousands of them.
I find myself thinking about everything that I ought to do in life, everything that I've done wrong. I go back through all of the experiences of my life and where I thought that I should have done something better. The third day, the last day of the pilgrimage, everyone is exuberant because if you've made it to that last day, you know you're going to make it. You know you're really going to make it. You're in forest, you're in fields. Endless, endless fields. You at least get to see, after a certain point, the spires of Chartres in front of you. It can become particularly grueling because it takes a long time for that spire in the distance to really get truly bigger.
There was more of a maybe a penitential spirit yesterday. But today it's just joy. It's just joy.
When you get onto the roads in the real suburbs of Chartres, then you can see it looming more and more. And then you begin this walk, which is a last torturous walk, up this long, shaded path that takes you up into the town itself. That's when you see it there, in all of its glory. What most stirs me up is the fact that you've managed to do it. You've managed to do it. You've finished it. When we're at Chartres, we have a solemn high mass, and all of this is surrounded with a great deal of ritual and ceremony. You could see 10,000 or 15,000 fervent Catholics, most of them young people, deeply committed to this traditional rite of mass. These people who are part of the pilgrimage and then who finish the pilgrimage with us as well, their spiritual fervor is accompanied with, again, a great love for music. By the time it's over, the feeling of exaltation is hard to describe, just hard to describe. The newer generation found what that old rite had to offer, spiritually satisfying, spiritually uplifting, and in a way that you could see almost in no other event that took place in the annual life of the church. The entire 3 days is emotional. This spirit of pilgrimage should be continued on a day-to-day basis for the rest of your life.
That's our program for now. I'm Fred DeSam-Lazaro. There is much more on our website, including more of Kim Lawton's interview with Genevieve Abdo on Iran. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, scenes from the Catholic pilgrimage to Chartres.